political leaders manipulating uncertain information into public policy. Years later, after turning against the war and deciding that something must be done, Ellsberg copied over 7,000 pages of the top-secret history of U.S. policy in Vietnam, and after failing to convince any senator to put them into the public record, passed them to the New York Times. That individual action, which at the least put Ellsberg at risk of a long prison term, changed the outcome of the war. Daniel Ellsberg tells the tale of the release in Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. He joins us in our studio. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I thought we could start historically and move up to where we are today. And I wonder if we might just take that Gulf of Tonkin day, because as you write about it, you write about the fog of misinformation that came into the office as you were there.
That's right. The book actually begins, in effect coincidentally, but dramatically as it turns out, with my first hours in my full-time job on my first day as a full-time employee of the Pentagon. I'd been a consultant for years before that. But my day started with couriers running, literally running, into my office with flash cables saying that a destroyer was under attack in the Tonkin Gulf, 12 time zones away. This was early in the morning of August 4th, and it was at night, in a moonless, dark night, cloudy, no moon at all. And the only knowledge of the attack that they had, which at first they thought was sufficient, was sonar indications of torpedoes coming at them. Every few minutes, the courier would come in with a new flash message from the deck, the bridge, I should mean, of the destroyer in charge of the two destroyers there, from Captain Herrick, saying another torpedo, four torpedoes, seven torpedoes had been fired in the water. Eventually, the figure reached 21, which was a little peculiar because that was more than our intelligence figured was in the entire inventory of the North Vietnamese Navy. But at first, then, there seemed to be no ambiguity. There was an attack going on an American warship. And even before the attack started, but with the first supposed indications that there was about to be an attack, President Johnson had decided on a response which was now fully underway. The first bombing, which took place that night, Washington time, morning in the Tonkin Gulf, took place on the morning of August 5th. The bombing went on for 7 years. And before a few hours had passed, that warning became totally ambiguous because Captain Herrick of the destroyers said, in effect, hold everything. All reports, previous reports of torpedoes, except the first one, he said, it took him 30 years to decide that there had been no first one either, said all the others are false. They seem to have been reports by an overeager sonar man hearing echoes of the ship's propellers against the wake as we took evasive action. So he recommended very quickly not doing any action until they'd had time for daytime upon reconnaissance looking for wreckage of PT boats they thought they'd destroyed, which they found none of. There had been no second attack. But the president announced that night that there was unequivocal evidence. Today, Rumsfeld seems to use the word bulletproof, but he said unequivocal evidence of an unprovoked attack on ships, American warships, in international waters conducting a routine patrol. And he said, we have just sent these bombing missions over North Vietnam, but in retaliation, but we seek no wider war. In my job as a very insignificant clerk, in effect, a high-paid clerk with very good access to the information, I already knew all of those statements by the president were false.
You knew that they were seeking greater involvement in the war.
They had every intention of a wide war soon after the election in this case, because the voters definitely did not want a wider war. They wanted a Tonkin Gulf resolution authorizing the president, which they got 3 days later. Congress, by the way, has just passed Tonkin Gulf 2, an almost carbon copy of that authorization for a blank check for wider war, except with the place names changed. There had been provocation. Indeed, we were conducting unannounced, unacknowledged attacks by U.S. Navy ships, which Secretary McNamara falsely described as South Vietnamese boats. against North Vietnam.
Those ships were bombing a couple of small islands in the
They were shelling islands and using 81-millimeter mortar rounds. They were kidnapping fishermen. They were placing mines. They were doing acts of war, which we didn't acknowledge, and which, by the way, they say are lied about to this very day in terms of who was doing it. We were doing it. I knew that because I was carrying a schedule of proposed action around to be initialed by the State Department at the highest level, McGeorge Bundy, in the White House. They were authorizing the utmost details of actions that were, in effect, squad or platoon-type actions, because it was the only war we had, and it was a secret.
Those haven't been acknowledged yet?
The fact that all that has been acknowledged in the record, well, I should say, I put it out.
In the Pentagon Papers.
In the Pentagon Papers. But the Pentagon Papers themselves were written top-secret documents. It did not, pardon me, did not make fully clear that these ships were, in fact, totally U.S.-owned, U.S.-bought, U.S.-operated, although with mercenaries from around the world, CIA assets. They had Norwegian pilots at first, Thai and Chinese nationalists from Taiwan, some Vietnamese that were essentially mercenaries, all run by the CIA. They were as much U.S. Attacks as the U.S. destroyer attacks, rather patrols, just off the coast of Vietnam. And when we found that we could get an attack on August 2nd, that was an attack that did occur in daylight, in contrast to the alleged attack 2 days later, which did not take place, did not exist. But the August 2nd attack, when we found we could get them to attack a destroyer if we were sufficiently provocative in the operation of that destroyer, that got the Pentagon very excited, both civilians and military, to figure out now, how can we get the next big provocation, that is, attack retaliation was, that will justify us going into a full-scale, sustained war against Vietnam.
Daniel Ellsberg is our guest. He's written Secrets, a Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. In the 70s, Daniel Ellsberg leaked those Pentagon Papers, top secret papers, to the New York Times. Well, and we're going to get to that story, but I just want to continue with the history a little bit. So you had been in Vietnam. You had been a commander in the Marines, and then you had gone back to Vietnam.
Well, that's a little misleading. I had enlisted in the Marines as an officer candidate, and I was an officer. I was proud of the fact that I became, as a first lieutenant, a company commander. A glow of pride comes over me even now when I think of that, because first lieutenants don't get to command rifle companies. But and that was a very satisfying time in my life. But that was in the 50s, during peacetime. I did extend for a year in 56. I was due to get out. But when I understood that my battalion was likely to be involved in a war in the Middle East, which became the Suez Crisis in 56 and 57, I extended for a year and I stayed in and did go to the Mediterranean with my battalion. But when I was in Vietnam, I was a civilian. And I was able to, my job was evaluating pacification, which in part involved combat operations by Vietnamese and Americans in the provinces. And I used my Marine training to take part in those as an observer.
You went on patrols?
I went on more than patrols, patrols and battalion-sized operations. I was shot at, even shot back, which is another story told in the book, a little questionable, but there I was. And I did see that war up close. So like many other Americans, it became very clear that what we were doing was not going to succeed in Vietnam. And I knew from my work in the Pentagon that I knew more than the troops in the field how heavily we were bombing North Vietnam. The idea that we had an arm tied behind our back, which many of the troops were led to believe, was very misleading. We dropped more bombs on all of Indochina in that operation, four times as many as all of World War II. So we were not being insufficiently ruthless, really.
But that's the argument that's the argument we hear today in terms of from military commanders and political leaders that in Vietnam there wasn't, the military wasn't able to win the war.
That's a myth. Just as in Germany after World War I, there was the myth of the stab in the back, that they were on the verge of victory, but that liberals and civilians had pulled them away from it. Germany wasn't about to win the war in World War I, and we were not ever about to win the war in Vietnam.
So there, but there were these papers, there were analysis by you, by other people in the field, that were already arguing that as early as, even in the late 50s, even in the early 60s, there were people that were looking at the policy and questioning what
would happen. Yes, in effect, the greatest secret, not fully revealed in the Pentagon Papers, was how many people, because they were written, this is a secret that was too secret to be written down at all, was how many people and how high-level authoritative people were warning the president that this was a catastrophic risk that he was taking that might work out, just like now, but that was highly unlikely to lead to anything but, as Clark Clifford put it, catastrophe
but
for
not
our
just,
country.
Not just Johnson, but Kennedy and even Eisenhower.
Everyone had been told that there was very little prospect of success, and early on, the people didn't quite seem to realize it. They were very aware from 45 and especially from 49 and 50 on, we were paying all the finances of a war that was very straightforwardly a war of French colonial reconquest of a former colony, Indochina, that had declared independence. Now, that wasn't strictly illegal under the UN Charter of that day, because the UN Charter allowed for colonies and to take place or existed. It was certainly against American tradition of self-determination and our own pride in having freed ourselves from an empire. So from the point of view of the American public and our traditions, that war had no legitimacy from the beginning. I didn't understand that while I was there. I thought it was a worthy cause against communists. How could you be wrong fighting against communists?
Well, who,
that's the way I felt.
If that was the case, who continued to pursue the policies early on?
Each president and each man who served them did it because, I think the best explanation there is that the Democrats so injured politically and psychologically by being charged with having lost China, which, by the way, in an absurd charge, the U.S. had no possibility of preventing the Chinese communists who had fought the Japanese and successfully fought Chiang's nationalist armies from taking power in China. There was no strategy that would have averted that. But the Democrats, amazingly, unforeseeably, were in power after 1948. They were supposed to be turned out in 48, but Harry Truman won a surprising victory and won the very dubious privilege of being in office when the Chinese took over. A generation then went by where they faced the charge of having lost China, having been weak, having been irresolute. And that was a major factor in our actions, in the Democrats' actions in Korea, and certainly in Indochina. No president, including Republicans who had waged that charge, who had leveled that charge, wanted to see it leveled against them. And so each of those presidents, to avoid being in office when communists took control in Vietnam, which, given the history and the sociology and the politics of the place, they all knew was inevitable eventually. But they wanted to postpone it, and they were willing to pay almost any price in American lives and Vietnamese lives to postpone that until after they were out of office.
So, always a political calculation.
It was, I think, almost entirely a political calculation.
All right, well, let's take a break and come back with Daniel Ellsberg, who has written Secrets, the Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, and we'll bring your calls in as well at 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869, or email us weekday, KUOW.org. support for KUOW comes from Antioch University's BA degree completion program in liberal studies. Their open house is at 6 p.m. Tuesday, October 22nd. For information, call 206-268-4202 or visit online at antiochfea.edu. Change your life. Change the world. Antioch.
Some of us, and we know who we are, get headaches all the time. What causes them? What's happening in the brain? And what can be done? The latest on headache research, next hour on Weekday. Listener supported, Public Radio. Daniel Ellsberg had been working as an analyst at the RAND Corporation looking at defense studies when he decided to release the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and brought to light the secret history of the war in Vietnam. He's written about that in his new book, Secrets, a Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. I'll say it now. Daniel Ellsberg will be at today at noon at the University of Washington talking about some of these issues. And again, tonight at 7 at Kane Hall, University of Washington Bookstore-sponsored event. You worked through the years in the Pentagon and then later as a hired-on doing these studies. You worked with George Bundy. These were McNamara studies. This was Pentagon paper in part were called the McNamara papers, right? You worked with Henry Kissinger and consulted with Kissinger later. I wonder if you look back on that, I understand the political calculation, but these are the people that were hired to oversee what was going on, to give the political leaders clear data about what was happening. Did they? Did Kissinger? Did McNamara? Did McGeorge Bundy? Did they color the data that came to the president?
Not so much to the president, as a matter of fact. I should make one thing clear. When I said it was domestic politics, remember that to political people who are in the whole, certainly in the executive branch where my real experience was, and I'm sure in Congress as well, have really very idealistic motives as well. They want to make the world a better place. They want to protect this country, just as I did and do now. But I'm not a more patriotic or more conscientious now than I was when I was keeping these secrets and telling, in effect, protecting these lies at the time. So you can ask, why do they participate in such deception of the public? And your question is, do they comparably deceive the president? The surprise of the Pentagon Papers and what comes later is, no, the answer to that last part, they do not comparably deceive the president. The president got quite adequate warning of the difficulties and the cost. It was his decision not to pass that on to the public, and of course they went along with that. But when you say domestic politics, which was crucial to the president, not, as you say, to a person like McNamara or Kissinger or me at my level, we weren't involved in domestic politics. But we all accepted the notion, working for a president, that the president himself accepted. It's not just domestic politics. All the things he wants to do for the country, all the dangers he wants to avoid, depends on staying elected and having power in Congress, having majorities in Congress if possible. It's a requirement. So the domestic politics is, of course, very important to their jobs and their future, but also to the country. They feel that they're not perfect, but they'll do a better job than the alternatives. So you're serving the world and you're serving the country by getting reelected and staying reelected. In the course of that, you tell the public what they need to hear to support your policies. No political leader almost ever, and this is true in the Hill, I'm sure, too, but executive branch never tells all their reasons or even the main reasons why they think a particular policy is necessary. That just wouldn't get as much support as they can get by telling the public something else. One audience this, one audience that. What I would say right now, there's a tremendous thing. I believe that what the Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and the president are telling the public about their reasons for going to war in Iraq are as deceptive and manipulative as the presidents I served, Kennedy, Johnson in particular, Nixon also, and for similar reasons. They believe in their policies. They don't think they would get adequate support for those policies from this public, so they tell the public something else.
Any evidence of that in what you know? Anything that you
mean right now? I don't have inside knowledge, but some of the things that are being said very flatly are patently absurd. The idea, for example, that we hope for and expect a democratic regime in Iraq, and that in turn to inspire democracy in the Middle East, is to someone who has a first grade education in the thing, which is about what I have at this point, is simply absurd. Democracy is not in the cards in Iraq of a real sort, and we wouldn't allow it because it would lead to a split between the Kurds, the Shiites, the Sunnis, which we promised our allies, the not very democratic Turks and the not at all democratic Saudis, that will not allow to happen. So there's not going to be Shiites, Muslims, are 60%, that's the religion of Iran as well, they're 64% of the Iraqi population. Is there a chance that we will allow democracy to bring a Shiite to power in Baghdad who might ally with Iran? There is zero chance of that. So the next question is, when Cheney says that's what we're after, is democracy, when the president says that, can he possibly believe that? Or is he consciously lying? Well, on the first side, I did learn in the Pentagon the Ellsberg principle, which is anyone can be as dumb as he has to be to keep his job. But in this particular, intelligence is no obstacle, and Cheney is as smart as they come. Can he believe even that? No, actually, I don't think he does. He knows we're not heading for democracy. We're heading to replace a monstrous, tyrannical dictator in Iraq with a dictator more to our liking.
When you started coming up against the policies and seeing it differently, you were not the only analyst in the Pentagon that thought this way. There were other people that
I didn't know anybody who thought differently.
So what, and this was 67.
So the next question is, what do you do about it?
Yeah. And what were you all doing before you made this decision to step outside? Yeah. Quit. And
I had earlier been initially one of the first things on this book tour that was scheduled was to talk at Microsoft to a lecture program they have there, and that was canceled about a month ago for they felt I would imbalance their program somehow. So I was disappointed. Because my message, and I'd be happy to be invited there any time in the future. In fact, if any Microsoft employees are hearing this, I invite them to come to Paragon Hall, Parrington Hall of Commons, University of Washington, room 308 at 12, or the event scheduled tonight at the University Bookstore, Kane Hall, Rethke Auditorium at the University of Washington. Because the main message of my book is, or rather, a theme, are the ethical and practical problems faced by officials or employees whose president is deceiving the public or lying under oath, as officials don't usually get under oath. Presidents certainly don't, but actually Nixon did, as it worked out, and Vice President Bush had, and they did both lie under oath. What do you do? Johnson didn't have to go under oath. His lies were or not technically perjury. But what do you do if you feel that lives are at stake? The more general problem, I had a feeling that there might be some Microsoft employees who could relate to that issue. But it isn't just the government. What do priests in the Catholic Church do when they know their bishops and their archbishops have been deceiving the public in various ways? Officials at Enron, WorldCom, Tyco, all the others we've been hearing about, tobacco companies, and right now in the CIA and the White House and the National Security Agency. Well, some of them have been behaving very creatively, in my opinion. We've been getting more unauthorized disclosures. That's the official term for leaks than we ever had in Vietnam. And very usefully, there would not have been 133 votes in the House against authorizing the president giving him a free hand in this war, an undated declaration of war. Without those unauthorized disclosures, there would not have been 23 Senate votes. After all, there were two in the first Tonkin Gulf resolution in the Senate. There were zero votes against Tonkin Gulf resolution one in the House, and that was because no one in the government, including me, told them the truth the way some people have been doing now. But we need a lot more of that.
So you're arguing for the whole whistleblower concept. The whistleblower...
Absolutely, and I'm applying for it should apply not only to corporations, where it's needed much more than we get it, but much more in what's called the national security bureaucracy.
But people thought of you as a traitor. There were people who wanted to, well, people put you on trial, and you could have gone to prison,
right.
But people thought of you as a traitor for revealing these...
For someone as patriotic as I am, in a very conventional sense, enlisted in the Marines, grew up World War II, fighting aggression in Korea and elsewhere. I was deferred during Korea, but I thought it was a just war. So I got in, I did enlist during the Korean emergency, and as I say, went to the Far East, I mean, the Middle East at that point. I went into combat in Vietnam. I'm as patriotic as they come. To be called a traitor is very hurtful, but I had decided that where lives were at stake, being called names was not something that was going to stop me. By people who didn't know me, even very hurtful names. You know, we were talking about the history here. I think the Democrats in particular, who were in office when we, quote, lost China, have reacted to that ever since up to today. And they were thought of as being losers in Vietnam, although there was no way to win. There was no Republican route to real victory in Vietnam. But they were in office. They thought of as having been stalemated in Korea. Again, we could have broken through that only at the risk of nuclear war with China. But they face that, and they don't like it. I don't think it's sheer domestic politics. There's a psychological dimension to this. Democrats and Republicans alike, the ones who voted against this resolution, like Chafee in Rhode Island, and Jim Leach and others who in the House, Republicans, but Democrats in particular, were afraid of being called weak on terrorism, weak on Saddam. Now, they knew that this war was going to hurt our struggle against terrorism. It was going to cost, it is going to cost American lives. It is going to do nothing to reduce our dangers. But they know the public doesn't know that, and they will be charged with unfair but very damaging claims. I think that very many Americans have died in the last 50 years, and 10 times as many foreigners, because essentially of democratic fears, psychologically, of being labeled unmanly, weak, insufficiently concerned about the military and aggression and so forth. And to avoid that, they are willing to take risks that in fact result in the loss of many, many lives.
Why do you say that they know that anything that goes in, that occurs in Iraq won't have any effect on the war on terror?
Because of the not only unauthorized disclosures, but such revelations as the unclassified letter that that Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, of whom I hadn't been a very big fan up till now, and now I give him full credit, he gave the honest opinion, I believe, that's my judgment, the honest opinion, because it didn't help him with his president, I'm sure, that there was no evidence of any connection between Saddam and Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda being a real threat to this country, in a way that Saddam, if he's not connected, and we have no evidence that he is connected, Saddam is not even comparably a threat to this country. He also said that there was a high chance that if we attacked him, then he would use what chemical weapons that he had against us and Israel, or biological weapons, and that could lead to the use of nuclear weapons by Israel or this country. Now, these are enormous risks which came out. There's two aspects that bear on the war on terrorism very quickly. I am sure that Osama bin Laden, wherever he is praying, because he's a very devout man, he is praying for this attack to take place, because it will result in two things. No matter how careful we are with our smart bombs, there will be television pictures around the Arab and Muslim world, if not here, real pictures of Muslim women and children being slaughtered. That will result in a flood of recruits, of suicide bombers, to Al-Qaeda, much more than it has now. And it will result in such outrage in countries with Muslim majorities that their leaders cannot cooperate with us in intelligence and police operations against Al-Qaeda. That's dangerous for us, and that's what this war is almost sure to result in.
I want to come back to that, but I want to bring some callers in. But just one last quick thing. It's the whole idea of secrets here that we're working on. Now, Rumsfeld and Cheney and others have alluded to the fact that there's more information that many members of Congress aren't privy to and the American people aren't privy to. And their concern is that with secrets released, we compromise individuals who reveal that information.
Okay. They are saying that. And of course, it could be true. How is my judgment? I'll tell you why I judge that that's very unlikely to be true. We now do have an apparatus which is extremely reliable. Information secrets have occasionally, but very rarely, come out that have to be kept from the Senate and House Intelligence Committees. Members of those committees, including the chairman, Bob Graham, who is no liberal, particularly known to me, voted against this bill and have stated they have received no information in their higher than top secret briefings from the Congress, from the president, that would support the president's claims that there is a link between Saddam and Al-Qaeda, or that Saddam is likely to use nuclear weapons or other weapons against the U.S. if he is not attacked. Now, I believe if the administration had such evidence, they would have shared it with those committees. And when Barbara Boxer, as a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, she doesn't give any secrets away. She just says a big secret, which is, I haven't seen anything in that committee that would at all confirm these claims. She doesn't. Her colleague in California, Barbara Feinstein, Diane Feinstein, who voted for the bill, she wants to be, I believe, vice president someday, if not president. She voted for that bill, but not because she knew something that her colleague, Barbara Boxer, did not know. Barbara Boxer's on the Intelligence Committee. When Senator Kerry, who definitely wants to run for president, voted for this bill, it was not because he knew something that his colleague, Edward Kennedy in Massachusetts, did not know. So I do not believe the claim that they have intelligence that they can't afford to share with the public that would support their claims. I don't think they have such intelligence.
Right, let me bring a couple of listeners in before our break, which is coming soon. Alex, thanks for calling.
Hi. I wanted to ask Mr. Ellsberg, what was the nature of the intelligence in the Pentagon Papers that was deemed to be such a huge and terrible secret to disclose? And does it relate to the case of another analyst, the CIA analyst, Sam Adams, who was studying enemy strength estimates in Vietnam and who was later run out of the CIA because he said that the military intelligence in Saigon had been, in fact, faking the enemy strength estimates?
Actually, that's a very well-informed question. Sam Adams volunteered and thus, in effect, gave up his career to testify against the prosecution or for the defense in my trial. And it was not because he was a friend of mine or even really liked my position or what I was doing. I never really met him. And in his memoir, he was quite negative toward me. But he was an analyst like many people in the government who did take truth as not only a very high value but as important for our policy and for the American public, and he didn't like deception, especially going after the public. In his case, he pointed out that I was being put on trial in part for releasing a memo from Senate General Wheeler to the president on that involved in part estimates of the strength of the Viet Cong. As Adams testified under oath, he didn't feel that could have hurt national security since the estimates were false. The Viet Cong, as he'd been pointing out, were twice as large as Wheeler was saying, and to conceal that from the American public, as General Westmoreland and Wheeler did participate in doing, Westmoreland, I think, for not bad motives in a way, but she was obeying the president. To do that was against our national security.
Let me come back to that. With Daniel Ellsberg, we'll take a break and come back on weekday on KUOW Northwest Public Radio.
Support for KUOW comes from the Perennial Tea Room, offering a collection of teapots, cozies, and teas from around the world. The Perennial Tea Room is open daily in the historic Pike Place Market from 9:30 to 6. Telephone 206-448-4054 or online at perennialtearoom.com.
I'm Marcy Silman. The Northwest Book Fest brought dozens of writers to Seattle this weekend. Fall is new book season for American publishers. Librarian and book critic Nancy Kroll picks out some highlights for us, plus music from Seattle Baroque. It's coming up at 2 o'clock on The Beat on 94.9 KUOW Seattle.
Daniel Ellsberg was working, just left the RAND Corporation, didn't want the RAND Corporation to be involved when he leaked the Pentagon Papers, 7,000 pages of secret history of the war in Vietnam that revealed that some of the facts that the American people had been told about the Vietnam War were not facts at all. Secrets, the memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Let me bring Misha into this with a question. Hello, Misha.
Hi. I wanted to say it's a great honor to talk to you, Mr. Albert Ellsberg.
Thank you.
I had a worked as a case officer in Vietnam, and I think you're a real patriot. I wondered about your opinion as to whether the leadership, Secretary of State McNamara, for example, and Henry Kissinger, should be brought up or charged with war crimes for their activities in Vietnam, and for, in the case of Kissinger, for other activities in Chile and other places.
You know, I have very mixed feelings about that, in a sense, and always have. First of all, at the time and later, I was not interested in retribution or trials or punishment. I wanted to get that war ended. And when you put people totally on the defensive, by the way, facing crime, criminal trials, the chance that they will start telling truths that will help get us out of that war is reduced. So as a practical thing, no question, these people, including me, it was not a question of pointing fingers here. I never believed that. I was involved in these policies, obviously, at a lower level, not to be pretentious, but I was part of the apparatus. They were much higher parts. Another leading thing about pointing directly to McNamara or Kissinger to this day is they're singled out in particular because they're still alive and they're available, but to imply that they were the architects of the policy rather than their now dead presidents is very misleading. The president in the end makes these decisions, and as I've been saying earlier, it's a mistaken belief that he makes these decisions mainly on the result of inadequate or misleading information to him. It's lies by the president that are far more significant, and I learned that from the Pentagon Papers. That was the message. So much, as you know, a lot of lying does go up the system. A lot of people at your level, if you're a case officer down there, if you're a province level, if you're a advisor, was very truthful. But on the way up the system, it gets distorted, to be sure. And a lot of us thought in the system, it must be that the Tsar doesn't know, if only the Tsar knew, to use the old Russian expression. That turns out not to be true. Yes, there is a lot of lying goes up, but enough truth gets out. So, the next question on these is, of course, did Kissinger, for example, participate in totally against American law, against American traditions, constitution, in overthrowing the democratic government in Chile? Now, that was no Iraq. That was a fully democratic government, which President Nixon didn't like because the leader was an avowed Marxist, not a communist, but a Marxist. But he'd been elected. He could have been reelected. It was a terrible act to overthrow that. But to suggest it could be misleading to single out one person and say as if he were the total architect of that thing. We have to understand these are American policies, and as you know, the CIA is not a rogue elephant. It is following, whether it should follow or not, but it is following loyally the policies of the president, no matter how crazy or criminal they might happen to be.
You know, the study you answer about when you start releasing information and expecting truth from the people you're exposing is not likely to occur. That was the argument that was given against releasing the Pentagon Papers, that exposing these truths will not end the war because it won't force Nixon or Kissinger or any of the others to. They're not going to fess up, they'll, you're right.
People think that there's nothing individually, whether they're a private citizen or they're a Secretary of State. They tell themselves that if I do something that might involve telling the truth, but would not affect it would not affect events. It would have no effect. So why take the risk of ending my career, maybe going to prison? But mostly, it's prison is not involved. Ending my career is a real risk. By telling truths your boss doesn't want known. There is a positive message very much of this book. I hope it will encourage people, in a way, to consider right now. That's why I happen to think this book is extremely urgent, so much so that 2 days ago I put as much as I could negotiate out of Viking to put on the Internet. They're trying to sell this book now. I don't want to wait for people to buy all of it. Some of the most relevant passages I urged them, and we did put on the web on my website, which my son Michael constructed for me, Ellsberg.net, ELLSBERG.net. And I put the first chapter and a few pages of chapter 4 in the preface. It would have been more if it's been up to me, on the net so that people could see what was happening right now and possibly avert it before the bombs are falling. And the message that I wanted to put out, which is in my preface, I hope this book will encourage people in the government to do or consider doing what I wish I had done in 1964 and early 65 before the bombs were falling. And that is, go to Congress and the press and tell the truth with documents. It is, people don't do that because they tell themselves it will not only have costs in their personal relationships, in their teams, in their jobs, in their careers, which is true, there will be risks, but that it can do no good. This book shows otherwise. It can do good. The power to tell the truth is a power held by individuals in corporations, in the Catholic Church, and not only the Catholic Church, in hierarchies everywhere. The power is a great power to change wrongful policies and dangerous policies that depend on secrecy and deception to be viable.
Let me bring in one last caller here, and then I have a follow-up question. Barbara's in Redmond. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, guys.
Go ahead.
First of all, it's such an honor to speak with you. And secondly, I just wondered how you translate what we actually hear on the radio and television today into what's really happening.
I'm glad you asked that, because the first principle from this book, which I hope you had a chance to read, and the first chapter on the web, Ellsberg.net, will give you that picture, is you cannot get even approaching an adequate impression by relying mainly on statements by government officials from the president on down. That just will not give you an adequate picture. So where do you look, since the newspapers can spend a lot of time reporting those statements? Fortunately, we do have the Internet now. There are sites like antiwar.com and commondreams, one word, .net, which give a wide variety of editorials and news from all over the country and all over the world. Read those, and you think there's nothing but criticism of the policies, but you can inform yourselves very much better than you could just by reading newspaper or television accounts of what the president is saying.
You think you can get informed, not just other opinions?
I think very informed. And the next question is, what do you do about it? If you're in the government, you can add to that information by putting some of this information out. How about other people? I just read in a Seattle paper just the other day about another website called MoveOnPact.org. It's a, might be net, or, you know, org, I think, capital M, capital O, and capital PAC, if that matters, which enables you to send money by credit card to people who will give it to people like Inslee in Oregon, who's benefited from this, Paul Wellstone in Minnesota, another person who voted for it in Washington, has gotten money in tight races here, and money counts in these campaigns. But also, by the way, just letting them know, the ones who voted right on this, like Patty Murray, let them know that you're supporting them in that, and especially the ones who are up for election in the House right now, and the ones who didn't vote right, say it's time to get right on this. And that raises one final question, how to get more information out. It occurs to me that there's going to be a lame duck session, perhaps before the bombs are falling. I'm afraid there's a serious chance that the bombs will start falling before the election. That's another matter. But in any case, in what time we have left, hearings in Congress that brought the kind of witnesses that are experts and can inform us better authoritatively, like Scott Ritter, who has wanted to be called a former UN inspector, former Marine, who has been telling the truth about this in a very good way, authorities like Nelson Mandela, who are opposing this war, saying that it's criminal and aggressive, and have great authority. A subcommittee, a committee of Congress, could bring these people informally or formally before Congress and get us information that we don't have now.
Suppose there was information that said, oh, here's the link. Let's stick with Iraq. I was going to go to Afghanistan, but let's stick with Iraq. Suppose there was a link in information, and the government released it. And they gave us a corroborating evidence came out through the United Nations.
Okay, two stages there. First of all, they probably get evidence supporting what they're saying in some degree every 2 hours, roughly. Reports, unsubstantiated reports, ambiguous reports, as in the Tonkin Gulf. McNamara and Johnson really did believe the night of August 4th that there had been an attack. There hadn't been. But they had cables that they misinterpreted, that they sincerely believed, I think, for hours or a day or two, did substantiate that. So merely to have something in hand is not the last word on this. It has to be looked at. It has to be examined by intelligence experts. It has to be looked at by the senators when they looked at it some years later, 4 years later. The senators looked at that supposed evidence and said, what does this prove? How does this lead to you? But, of course, so the first thing is to ask our representatives, but especially our senators, our top senators, who might be brought in on the event, when the president says, I have to go now, before the inspectors get in, or having nothing to do with inspection, before there's a UN resolution, I have to go tomorrow, literally tomorrow, or next week, or before the election, or just after the election, because I have to protect American troops. The first thing to do is to look very critically at that. Or I have evidence against all CIA analysts' expectations that now they were all wrong. They can be wrong. It turns out, and the evidence stands up, that Saddam actually is behind al-Qaeda and is a real threat to us. I could be persuaded by such evidence. I'm not a total pacifist by any means. If things turned out to be, as there's no evidence now, what the president is saying now, he could convince me. But I can tell you I wouldn't accept the first word I had of such evidence, and I would hope our senators didn't do the same.
You said, what did you suffer? What were the costs for you in the end for releasing these
people? Oh, ultimately, compared to the victims in Vietnam, our soldiers who are still suffering the effects of that, and the dead ones also, obviously. The Vietnamese were still suffering the effects of Agent Orange and all the dead. I was no martyr. I was no victim at all. That was not for their lack of trying entirely. People were sent to assault me at one point while I was on trial. They didn't carry it through. I was put on trial facing 115 years. I would be getting out in 2008 with good behavior after 35 years. So I could have suffered a good deal, but in fact they failed. My marriage is still thriving after 32 years, and not everybody who was put on trial had that luck.
So one analysis, it says that in part the releasing the papers did help speed to the end of the war because Nixon and Kissinger not liking what was going on with Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers coming out was distracted.
Well,
he didn't have the support he otherwise could have mustered in
Congress. No, I think that wasn't the reason, if I may say. That was the usual reason at the thought and at the time where he thought they knew he reacted strongly with the Foucault plumbers trying to get at me in various ways. It wasn't clear why he had done that. It's only come out quite recently in tapes, some of which are in the book, as to what they were thinking. As Bud Krogh here in town, who was in charge of the effort to get me and who is now a friend of mine, I'm proud to say, a really courageous and dedicated conscientious public servant who can look back on what he was doing in 71 and so forth as being as misguided as what I look back on when I was in the Pentagon. So we have a lot to talk about in common, and I feel very close to him. But he said to his judge when he pled guilty that the main purpose was not what I had already done in going after me and trying to get information on me at my former psychiatrist's office, was not to, in response to what I had done, which was putting out history about the Democrats, the study happened to end in 68. Of course, it revealed Eisenhower and Nixon as vice president, too, but that was old history. Nixon was very glad to get that out, the tapes now reveal. I didn't know that earlier. What he was afraid of was that I had documents of current relevance to what he had recently done and what he was about to do, possibly using nuclear weapons. It now comes out that he himself proposed the use of nuclear weapons to Kissinger at one point. That's why it's so important, I think, now for people not to do what I did, putting out history and not to wait till the bombs are falling. If you know the president is deceiving the public on matters of life and death, put out current documents right now while it's still possible to affect events.
All right, Daniel Ellsberg will be talking about these issues in Seattle at the University of Washington at noon in Parrington Hall. And tonight at 7 at Kane Hall, room 130. Secrets, the Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. Daniel Ellsberg, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for your phone calls. This is Weekday, produced by Arvid Håkansson. Dylan Blaylock is our engineer today. Chanel Tegger is answering our phones on KUOW and on Northwest Public Radio.